wait each night for someone exactly like you.
Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
You seem to understand each foolish little scheme I'm scheming, dream I'm dreaming. Now I know I'm mothers.
Meet Paul and Mary Bland.
You two live in the building. You must swing, right?
Wrong. Good night.
We're still lucky to have found each other.
A typical American couple.
I know. Good night, dear.
Sweet dreams.
With a typical American dream. And typical American problems.
You are through at Clay Liquor.
Mr. Leach, I'm sure the bank has nothing to worry about. It's going to get everything that's coming to it.
The bank wants to see what it's getting into.
With the Blands, life was just a rat race.
A cartoon mouse.
Oh, great. Trigger likes you already.
Oh, we like B and D, but we don't like S and M. We met at the A and P.
But they found a way to beat it. Until
Mr. Raul Mendoza, como esta usted?
They met a hot-blooded, emotional, crazy Chicano.
I'm a hot-blooded, emotional, crazy Chicano.
Eating Raul. Is it a thriller? Is it a romance?
This was very wrong.
Is it a tragedy?
Excuse me. May I sit down?
Yeah. Is it a comedy?
Yes, but not the type you're used to.
Eating Raul.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Rob St. Mary, and of course, joining me, Mr. Mike White.
Is this podcast Michelin rated?
No, maybe we can look into that. Also joining us this week, the host of the podcast, Proudly Resents, Mr. Adam Spiegelman.
Whip me, beat me, make me write bad checks.
This week, our special Thanksgiving episode, we're going to serve you an extra large helping of the 1982 comedy Eating Raoul. Directed by Paul Bartel, Eating Raoul stars Bartel and Mary Warnoff as Paul and Mary Bland, two kind of conservative folks living in the debauched playground of L.A. who realize that the ads on the back page of that alt weekly could lead them into the wallets of perverts and help to fund their American dream, their own restaurant. The only problem? How do you get rid of the bodies? That's when they meet Raoul, played by Robert Beltrand, who may just have the answer. Eating Raoul is a truly independent film shot by Bartel, best known for Death Race 2000, and it was done on a shoestring and has become a favorite of cult fans everywhere. So much so that the Criterion Collection put out a beautiful edition of the film on DVD and Blu-ray just last year. So Adam, as our guest, when was the first time you saw Eating Raoul, and what did you think?
Well, I saw it when I was 13 on the VHS, and you just heard about how cool this indie film from California was, you know. And it was all like satire, and to us it was punk rock and roll. But then when I watched it, I just fell in love with Mary, the lead. She was, to me, it was like the greatest thing ever. I don't know if there's more to it than that. I didn't know until I watched it again that it was an actual movie to it. But it had, the movie had kind of like a screw you quality. It was just silly and subversive and crazy.
What about you, Mr. White?
Gosh, I don't remember when I first saw it. It was probably also on VHS. I remember, for some reason, I remember the Siskel and Ebert review of it. And I guess it just seemed so different from the usual stuff that they were covering on the show that it really stuck with me. And then probably years later, or maybe not that long afterwards, I found it on VHS. And my folks loved it, and I loved it, and which is unusual that I actually like a movie that my parents like, or vice versa. But yeah, just this one really stuck with me, and this is how I kind of got introduced to Paul Bartel, and I'm glad that I got introduced to him this way.
What did Siskel and Ebert think of the movie?
I remember they liked it a lot. I seem to remember that they enjoyed it, and it wasn't, you know, they got the jokes, and they were kind of right along with it, if memory serves. I mean, it was just such a unusual movie for them to cover, you know, when they're doing the latest, whatever, Harrison Ford movie or whatever they're covering. But yeah, it was I was happy to see them talk about something so unusual.
I think for myself, I got into it probably on VHS, but I haven't seen it in a long time until this Criterion Edition came out, and I just bought it because I knew that I liked it years ago and wasn't disappointed going back to rewatch it again. But it definitely was one that I think I came to through Death Race 2000, because obviously that one was sort of more in the zeitgeist, at least if you were a cult film fan.
I was shocked that he did both films, because this is so like, it's so much like a Woody Allen movie. You know, just kind of like a subversive punk rock Woody Allen. I keep using the same terms, but that's how I always saw it. It was like Woody Allen for us, you know, for people who want something crazy. So then he did this action film, which really was the same thing. It was also subversive and not an action film. You know, it just seemed weird he did both movies.
Yeah, he had a really diverse career when you look at some of the stuff that he did, not just acting-wise, but directing-wise, like scenes from A Class Struggle in Beverly Hills and Cannonball that he did, and yeah, just some of the movies that he directed. He was all over the map. Oh, and then Lust in the Dust.
That's awesome. Oh, yeah, because we talked a little bit about that on the I Am Divine episode, because that was what, Divine's second to last film, because what was Hairspray considered the last?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And one of the few Divine roles where she wasn't working with John Waters.
Yeah, but it felt like, am I wrong that it felt like Lust in the Dust was like a John Waters film?
It kind of felt like John Waters light a little bit. There were some interesting parts to it. When I first saw it, I didn't really like it too much, but I watched it again recently because of the I Am Divine episode and liked it a lot more the second time.
Eating Raoul, what I find funny is that opening with all that stuff in L.A. Have you ever dealt with any of that stuff living out in L.A. there, Mr. Spiegelman?
Like what? Like
like ketchup on your ice cream?
And other debauched things. It is all about L.A.
It is a known fact that prolonged exposure to just such a psychopathic environment will eventually warp even the most normal and decent among us.
Yeah, L.A., it really actually brought me into L.A. I guess they shot it in the valley, but which is so funny. They're in Valencia is the country to them, and that's just way out in the valley. You know, it's just too far from the normal thing. But, yeah, I think it captured L.A. pretty well. It's just there are some weird people, but the feeling that, I hate to say it, but like the desperation of LA was really in this movie of people who want to make it, you know, I mean, that's what we have, and people who are there because it's a lottery and they couldn't make it. So at least in this movie it was for them to get a restaurant, but it made total sense that LA was the setting for this movie because that's where people go and they try to be something else. And the swinger scene, you know, I've never seen it because no one's asked me, but
otherwise you'd be right there.
I would be right there. My number is, and you know, it just seemed, it all that seems so LA. The people, the way the people didn't give a shit, the way the people did care. I mean, obviously, I've never seen anyone that aggressive with a woman, you know. But it was just funny that everyone, it felt authentic, even though they're caricatures.
Yeah, those swingers are really aggressive in this movie.
Hey, how you doing, pal? What? Am I early or what?
Huh? Well, the early bird gets a pussy, am I right?
Pussy? No,
Jesus,
come on.
She looks like a party all over herself.
No, come on. Out of here. Mister, you better get out of here and just
Hey, listen,
leave
you're not screwing her. Somebody's going to screw her. Might as well be me, man.
I'll screw you later, sweetheart.
Hey, baby. Hey.
Shouldn't have done that.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's like, are you a swinger or a rapist? Because there's no difference. In that movie, all swingers are rapists, basically.
Well, it seems like so many people are aggressive. I mean, even the guy who's running the liquor store where Paul is working, and then, of course, the robber that comes in. But I think my favorite is the guy that works at the porn shop.
Oh, that's great.
When he's poking Paul with that huge dildo and everything. So good.
I love that he had such pride in the porn shop.
Okay, your vibrator start at 10.95 and go up. We got the salami, the man of war, and alien.
Just give me the cheapest one.
Wait a minute. There's nothing cheap about my store. You mean inexpensive, don't you? Isn't that what you meant?
Yes.
That's what I thought you meant.
Yeah, John Paragon showing up, who's better known to most people as being Jambi from Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Oh, really? Oh, he was fantastic. Yeah, that also felt authentic. Not that I know, but that was the most realistic part. The cheap apartments and everything, it just looked like L.A. on the fringe, and that was perfect. North Hollywood is where they're from, I'm guessing. No offense, North Hollywood.
I think that was really what made me fall in love with the movie was Mary's line about selling your mother's fabulous 50s furniture and just the decor in the room. I just love the set and everything. And then, yeah, to your point earlier, just the desperation of these characters and just how they're like this little bubble of like not normalcy because they're so bland that they go beyond that, but just like it's them against the world and everybody is trying to get ahead and everybody's trying to get a piece and everything. And they're the only ones like that don't have the money and that are really trying to, you know, fulfill their dream.
It was great is that everyone, and this is, yeah, I can speak for LA because that's where I live, but they were above everyone else who was living like a normal person in LA, the swingers and everybody. They were normal, but they were above those normal people. And then as soon as they could, they jumped in and joined it and then killed them. So they were worse. But I felt like as soon as they had the opportunity to be a swinger, they took a chance and went in. And I thought that's also kind of an LA thing. Like, I'm too good to care about movies and care about what celebrities and this and that. Next thing you know it, you're driving around, you know, doing certain things. So that was pretty cool.
The satire in here, I think, is pretty great. And especially when you consider it's, what, 81 they probably made this. It took a while, and you'll hear in the interviews how long it actually took them to do this. And to me, it kind of is the it's almost a satire of Reagan, but Reagan hadn't even been in office that long. Because there's this whole sort of backlash on the free love swinging of the 60s and 70s and that whole counterculture. And it's almost kind of talking to the idea that we're getting more conservative in America and it's becoming money, money, money. And then this whole thing about let's go back to the old times, right? So the 1950s, they're sleeping in two beds. And then also it's very American in that violence, that's okay. But sex, uh-uh.
Right. Right, he hits the guys over the head, and they're okay with that. But
yeah, no problem whatsoever. I love how nonchalant they are about murder, and how easily they explain it away too. Where it's like, well, he was a person, but now he's just a bag of garbage. You know, just one line takes care of everything. There's no moral quandary whatsoever.
And these are swingers, right? So they're just filthy people who would go out and spread disease, right?
Who have a lot of money. Apparently all swingers have a lot of money.
They carry a lot of cash with them. And but I love that, yeah, they kind of just explain the movie away quickly in one line that swingers are all dirtbags and they're transient. No one gives a shit about them. Okay, let's kill them and take their cash.
Do you realize that we have made almost $1,000 in 2 days, tax-free?
Just by killing people.
Horrible sex-crazed maniacs that nobody in the world would miss. I wonder how much we could make if we really put our minds to it.
And their magazine was Hollywood, was like the Hollywood Rag. So they're kind of more than just the LA Weekly, which is like the Village Voice, you know, the alternative paper, but it seemed like it was their the Variety. So I love that. That in the trades, you know, people are looking for sex.
You killed two people for less than $1,000?
One of them shortchanged us.
That seems like a lot of work for not so much money.
As a matter of fact, it was easy. We lured those people here with an ad in the Hollywood Press, and then I hit them over the head with this.
The Hollywood Press?
That's right. This is Naughty Nancy.
No.
And Cruel Carla.
No, I don't believe it.
You don't believe it?
Show them the ad.
Come here.
Oh, man, that's fantastic. You know, I was going to answer that ad myself. I got to hand it to you. You guys got a very original scam going here.
Well, it was mostly Mary's idea.
Paul's just being modest.
It is so sweet to see such a loving couple as yourselves.
Well, it makes sense with the casting couch and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. And in that world, the casting couch definitely existed.
You're right, Rob. This definitely, I don't know what it was about the way that the pendulum couldn't have swung that fast. But I definitely think maybe that's why this movie was noticed so much more and did get, you know, national attention and everything, was because it was in the right place at the right time. By 1982, we did have 2 years of Reagan and his kind of, you know, city on a hill kind of idea, New Morning in America. I think we were just talking about that recently. And, you know, this was really, you know, speaking to that, even though I don't know if they were necessarily aware of that when they were making it. I think, you know, it just happened to capture that right at the right time.
And I think it's funny, too, that they get us to root for murderers. that they're our friends and we like them.
Yeah, and that Raul really, I have no problems with Raul either. And even though he's like trying to steal Mary away from Paul, and he could be the most despicable character, but I guess the way that Robert Beltran plays him, he's just so charming. And, you know that he's not necessarily doing right by Paul, but still you're kind of rooting for him along the same way.
And you almost kind of feel that Paul doesn't care about the fact that Mary and Raul are having sex. He just wants the money. Like, he doesn't feel offended by the fact that his wife's cheating on him.
They kind of brush that under, too. First of all, remind me not to have Mike around my wife, because they don't think that you're moral. I don't agree with those morals. But, he starts screwing with Raul when he realizes that he's sleeping with his wife. So he goes out and tries to get him deported and tries to get him fired. You know, he tries to screw with him back. But when he finds out his wife's cheating on him, he's like, no big deal.
Yeah, but don't try to steal from Paul, because he's got his dream. He wants that country kitchen.
Right. He's willing to let it go.
The whole thing that they've talked about with political scandals, right, is that Democrats are sex scandals and then Republicans are money hungry scandals. So it's kind of funny that Paul's like, the sex, whatever, just give me the money. So that kind of fits in, I guess, to this conservative side of him at the time.
They made it clear that they weren't having sex anyway. And it wasn't until Raul that she realizes she enjoyed sex.
Yeah, that whole double bed, I Love Lucy kind of setup that they had was great. And they even have, like, matching pajamas, right?
That was fantastic.
Yeah, I kind of like that. Really, Mary is almost, I would say that she's kind of the protagonist of this, in the way that she has a much bigger arc, in that she does kind of become aware of her sexuality and aware of drugs and all this. And then, yeah, I love at the end, she just kind of, you know, like you were saying, brushes it all away. It's like, he gave me this drug and then he raped me. And it's like, yeah, whatever.
We got more plot. Let's move on.
Right. I think that because of the kind of shoestring budget they were shooting this on, that it almost helped, you know, that we've got a lot of different scenes. We've got a lot of cuts. I was noticing the last time that I watched this that it moves really fast. And even within scenes, that there are a lot of cuts. And I don't know if that's just because they were doing the shooting on short ends or what it was. But, you know, these things, they move along, man. Like the party at the swingers place, you know, you're hopping. You're going right through there. And I think that helps this movie, too, is that not only are they kind of pushing aside the more what could be troublesome aspects of it, but just, you know, they are moving, man. There's just, we are going as soon as the movie starts, you know, you got a lot of cuts in that opening montage and they just keep with that same pace throughout.
And it's only 83 minutes. So it's quick.
Wow. And the party scene, I felt like they went so fast because they didn't have enough extras, because a lot of shots were against close to a wall. So the wall took up a lot of the space, and then they would have a person like walk around in the background. So it seemed like there's a lot more people there, and they cut around the lack of extras.
Well, yeah, that they could all fit in one hot tub was pretty good.
It blew my mind as a kid that they would do that. Killed him. He killed all these people in the hot tub, and then he's like, all right, now let's move on.
And I just love the way that they all slump over at the same time.
And I don't know, did you think the opening was necessary to set up how sleazy Hollywood was?
It really works for me. I don't know. I mean, it just kind of sets that world and really kind of puts Paul and Mary against it. I don't know. Did it work for you?
It did that to me. Like, it took me out of – I didn't remember it the first time I saw it. This time, if I hadn't seen the movie before, I would assume it was some kind of weird documentary. But it put me in that 50s mindset that is an innocent time. And they're innocent people in a fucked up world.
Right.
And they get corrupted by it. So, yeah, it really helped me out, I thought. Yeah, I liked it. It was just a weird choice, but definitely liked it.
Well, it's like there are certain jokes in there that, it took me a long time before I finally, I don't know, either got them or just acknowledged them. Like watching it again recently, and I think it's when Raul visits Mary at the hospital and you hear the announcement over the loudspeaker about that the male nurse's dance is going to be canceled. It's like, okay, you know, that was good. But it took me a long time before I finally you know, realized that that's what was going on.
It was funny because they say that twice, and I thought, why do they have to say that twice? That was for you. That's what they had to say.
It's from Mike White. Exactly. Yes. Just in case for those idiots in the audience that didn't hear it the first time. There you go.
They did it.
And just some of those little comments and stuff, especially at like the swinger party, there are little comments going on throughout.
It let you know that it wasn't, that he knew that anything that was bad in a film or low budget, they knew it was bad and low budget. And that anything that didn't make sense, you know, like it let you know that they knew what they were doing. I felt like.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, he definitely brought us in, you know, and I think that's what helps with that opening, too, is that he kind of is bringing you in and saying, this is going to be silly. And, you know, we know that it is, and you're coming along for this ride with us. So I kind of like that he does that. I mean, it feels very much, you know, you were using the term punk rock and stuff, and I can definitely feel that sensibility, and I can feel that. You know, it's that whole idea of punk being this kind of inclusive experience where it's just like, hey, come on, you know, you're cool, whatever's going on with you, come on in and, you know, come on into the club kind of thing. And that's the way that this movie feels. It feels kind of like, you know, like this, you know, inclusive experience. And then also it feels like an old friend when you go back to it all these years later. I mean, I've watched this two or three times just in the last few months. And when I popped it in for the first time in years, it was just like, wow, yeah, this really, you know, it feels like a piece of, you know, me growing up kind of thing that I forgot that I'd even, you know, had before, but it sure feels right.
It was like one of those USA Up All Night, Night Flight type things.
Exactly. Yeah, waiting for Julie Brown to come out and interrupt it every once in a while.
Ruin something good. Come on, I was enjoying this.
Sort of the fourth leg of the table, though, is Doris the Dominatrix. So if it's Paul, Mary, Raoul, now I'd say Doris. And she is so good. Susan Sager is so good in this. I especially love the scene, like you were talking a little bit about, where she's with the little boy and she's trying to talk to them about getting into the business and how to do that. And then when he, as you were saying, Paul sends her out to sort of mess with Raoul as a nurse and an immigration agent, it's just so funny. She does such a great job. And, like, having a character for all three of those, plus having her, like, self at home just taking care of her, I guess, her son in that scene.
Oh, and the blind nun. I love the blind nun. Oh, yeah. It's such a stupid throwing thing where she, you know, falls off the chair and everything.
Oh, she misses, like, the chair by a mile.
Yeah, I love it.
I totally, I think these guys are having the greatest time. They know this is ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I don't usually go for, you know, slapsticky kind of stuff, but I was just like, yeah, that works. Every single time, too.
They weren't above anything in this movie.
No.
It was still smart. It's, right? It wasn't, even Death Race 2000, like, he did a lot of ridiculous things, but it was still, you felt like he knew what he was doing. He was smarter than the material, and you trusted him.
And then the other cast, all the side characters that show up, like Buck Henry as the bank manager, and then Ed Begley Jr. as this hippie guy who comes, who's going to be one of the Johns, and Edie McClurg at the swingers party, and John Landis. Did you see John Landis, by the way?
No, what was he?
He's in the bank, right?
Yeah, he walks into the bank and, like, checks out Mary's ass real quick. It's like, blink and you miss him.
Oh, that's great. They had great cameos. Yeah, they had a lot of great people in that.
Yeah, don't forget Billy Curtis in there as the man with the dog.
Oh, and Ed Begley Jr. as the hippie. Yeah.
I don't know why we keep doing this, Mike, but I realized that probably the guy who shows up now more in any Projection Booth podcast. We didn't do this deliberately. It just seems that the real Don Steele keeps showing up. He's been now four of our episodes.
Hi, swingers. I'm Howard Swine, your hearty host that's hung with the most. Though I hate the most, I'm big as a post and warm as toast.
I know. Pretty soon, you know, we might want to call this the Real Don Steele podcast, you know, and just cover all the movies that he was in.
What are some of the films that you guys done that he's in?
Well, he was in Death Race 2000, right. Of course, as Junior. And then he was in Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park, working the crowd at the park.
Wow.
What else was he in?
He's in Gremlins.
Oh, then he was in Gremlins. Wow. Yeah, that's right. I forgot the radio DJ in Gremlins. And he's kind of there in cameo form on the billboard. So yeah. Apparently he was in Targets too. So maybe, you know, we can get Bogdanovich on and talk about Targets again with him.
Yeah, that's right. We're renaming it the Real Don Steele Podcast. Welcome.
If you could do your opening, that'd be fantastic. He's got a great voice.
It's kind of hard. He passed away.
Well, then, you know, it's not worth it.
Because he's not making any more new material. So, but we're going to be talking to Joseph McBride in a little bit. And I know that he did some work on the Rock and Roll High School. So maybe that'll be an episode sometime.
That's a great one. It's so funny. At that time, now they're running out of my head, but movies like this and Rock and Roll High School were all coming out at once. And I think it was like a movement of these weird films. And that's why I thought, that's what I associated with punk rock, because the Ramones obviously was in Rock and Roll High School. But they seem like they all came from the same school of kind of like fun, kitschy, alternative films. Not serious, not taking itself serious.
Well, they totally did. They came from that Corman school. I mean, that's where Bartel made Death Race 2000. That's where Rock and Roll High School was made. I mean, this kind of fits in. And Mary Warnoff and Paul Bartel were in all these things. Like Hollywood Boulevard, I think, is another one that fits right into that kind of thing. And so, yeah, I can totally see this having that kind of anarchic spirit of the Corman school.
Yeah, and it fit the 80s.
And also, Paul Bartel started out as an underground filmmaker in the late 60s. And I think we talked about this before we recorded the episode, Mike, about how Bartel's stuff in this one kind of remind you a little bit of Robert Downey Sr. in Putney Swope when we did that. And what's funny is on the Criterion, there is a there are two of his shorts, Secret Cinema and Naughty Nurse. And actually, a Naughty Nurse is Robert Downey Sr. So it's kind of funny that he got brought up in our discussion before, and then he's got a part in one of Bartel's films. Because in terms of the New York underground scene, I would say that the stuff that Bartel was doing was much more humorous than some of the other more serious art underground people.
Well, yeah, I guess it kind of fits. You know, we talked a few weeks ago about De Palma, and he was also in that same, you know, arena. And I would say that he, you know, wasn't taking himself too seriously either with like Hi Mom and Greetings and those kind of things. So I wonder if the East Coasters were a little less serious than the West Coasters or something, because that's where Dante came from also. They kind of imported him over there. But yeah, if folks haven't seen Secret Cinema, I mean, I totally recommend that. Naughty Nurse was pretty good as well, but Secret Cinema, absolutely love that. And they did a episode of Amazing Stories that was basically the exact same story, and Bartel directed that as well. So I would say either one, but really the original is where it's at.
How do you see that? Just on the Criterion Collection?
Both Secret Cinema and Naughty Nurse are on the Criterion. I have the Blu-ray, so it's on there. I'm sure it's on the DVD as well.
Or you can just go to your Blockbuster on the corner.
Oh yeah, just run so, right down there.
So easy, so easy.
So easy.
But, yeah. But the thing that's funny is, remember when we talked to Robert Downey Sr. and he was talking about the underground scene in New York at the time, and he talked about going to see these underground films and just how painful they were to watch, and how he wanted to put humor into them because everyone was so serious. And he talked about how bad the Warhol stuff was to sit through, especially as he said, you know, that one where he had one shot of the Empire State Building for 6 hours. It's like, how can you sit through that? So I definitely see sort of that same kind of anarchistic spirit at times with Paul Bartel.
It seems like you're going to do that, it has to be funny. You know, if they're going to hit something over the head politically with the Reagan era or the pre-Reagan era, it's got to be funny and it's got to be sexy, like just to keep your attention. I think there was enough humor and boobs to keep you going through the message of the film, you know, to keep you wanting to watch more of the movie.
Yeah, I think they did a good job, you know, showing a little bit of Mary's skin, kind of titillating us with that. And then I seem to remember during the swingers party, there's one shot where it's just like full on female nudity, just like lifting up the top, taking over the head. I'm just like, that is such a throwaway shot, but whatever, it works for me.
Why would they do that shot? Oh, yeah.
And remember that the guy who wrote it, co-wrote it, but directed it and is in it, was gay. So right. There you go.
Paul Bartel is gay?
Yep.
I don't know anything. I know he's not alive. I always, in my head, I thought he was with Mary. In my head.
that's what a lot of people thought. And when we, you'll hear the interview with Mary Warnoff later, and she talks a lot about that, how they kind of treated Paul and Mary as a couple. They were like a package deal when it came to a lot of the movies that they were in. But yeah, then people started, ended up thinking that they were a couple, and it's like, yeah, no, not really.
I had no idea. It was a weird. So Raul is selling these bodies to a dog food company. And did you guys, they kind of allude to it. Did you know it was dog food, or did you think it was Mexican food, as they try to make you think?
I figured it was dog food through it. And I think especially with that commercial and everything.
They had the talking dog. Well, that was after you found out, just to gross you out, they did that weird talking dog commercial.
Yeah, and where it's like the people eating the dog food. It was like, what?
What makes doggies happy? It's a simple thing. Feed them night and morning, let the doggy king.
You know, we talk about how this movie kind of brushes stuff under the rug when it comes to, like, you know, just murdering swingers and all this kind of stuff. There's really no problem with the cannibalism at the end of this film either. I don't know if Paul and Mary are enjoying Raul or not, but yeah, definitely their guest is, and we're just, okay, yeah, no big deal.
And how nice is it? They're always having the realtor over for dinner. That was really sweet.
Yeah.
They got to impress him and make dinner somehow. But
right, whether they're having chicken or Mexican. Yeah.
If I'm not wrong, Mary Warnoff did an ad for Alpo years ago.
Oh, really?
I just remember seeing that in the late 80s and just be like, whoa, was that woman from Eating Raul? Why would they hire her for this? They'd have no connection to that?
Oh, now I'm going to have to look that one up.
That was really bizarre. You know, you think somebody would check that out?
Yeah. Yeah, you would think so.
If she's associated with eating people for putting people on dog foods.
Well, I just want to say sorry that we spoiled it, but the title of the film is Eating Raul, so
right. Yes.
For me, I wish it was Paul Bartel is gay and that other guy is dead. That would have saved me a lot of embarrassment.
Sorry. Sorry.
Unbelievable.
I didn't mean to embarrass you in front of a national audience of people.
It's not me, people. It's a character I'm playing.
Oh, okay.
And scene. Now I'm back.
Nice.
Nice.
All right. We are going to take a break and play a few interviews, one with writer-producer Richard Blackburn, one with actress Mary Warnoff, who played Mary Bland, and Susan Sager, who played Doris the Dominatrix.
They're 12 miles of bad road, and now they have a microphone and their own show. It's the Daily Grindhouse Podcast, the official podcast of DailyGrindhouse.com. Starring G.
You tell that bitch who sent you here how sorry I am I can no longer be her friend.
And the man called Perry.
I'm the one that killed Munden, whooped and put Wims in the hospital. Called up Burrs, did a tell five, did not the Burrs, spare the old son.
Reviewing the hits and the hidden from the world of exploitation, cinema, and beyond. Featuring exclusive cast and crew interviews. Past guests include John Carpenter, Robert Forster, Brian Trenchard-Smith, but still no Steve Guttenberg.
We'll get him someday. We promise. I mean,
we promise. The Daily Grindhouse Podcast, available on iTunes, Stitcher Smart Radio, Podomatic, and of course at dailygrindhouse.com/podcasts. The Daily Grindhouse Podcast. Tough films for the rough crowd.
Got the goddamn message? Let's go to work.
This is Adam Spiegelman from the cult movie podcast Proudly Resents. And you listen to my favorite movie podcast, The Projection Booth. I know. It's messed up, right?
Hey, it's Rob St. Mary from The Projection Booth. And, you know, I want to tell you about a guy, kind of humble guy, I guess, my podcast partner. That's right, he has a new book out. His name's Mike White, and it's called Cinema Detours. The guy's so humble, he won't even bring it up on the show. I don't know what that's all about. But anyway, just want to say Cinema Detours got a chance to take a look at it, read through it, and it's kind of fun. I mean, you have these reviews for movies that you've probably seen before, And it's like chatting with an old friend. And then there's the movies that you haven't seen, which you got to add to your list and hopefully get to see before you die. Thanks a lot, Mike, for telling me about all these movies that I got to see now. But really, ultimately, why I'm coming to you about why you should pick up Cinema Detours either at Amazon.com or for your Kindle, or you can go over to projection-booth.com and pick it up as well, is because, you see, Mike's wife told me to do this. You might not know this, but Mike has 37 children, and he needs the money in order to take care of them. 37 kids, can you imagine? So Cinema Detours, projection-booth.com. You can also get it at Amazon, either in paper form or for your Kindle. So check it out. It's Mike White, Cinema Detours, and now I know why I don't get paid for this podcast.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that fucking burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst fucking piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, Scott. That was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
You know, I was looking for a little excitement, but I was worried about privacy. And then I found out about Vibrators.com. Vibrators.com has the perfect products for women and men and couples. They have helpful suggestions and information on how to make sure you get something just right for you. Plus, for over a decade, Vibrators.com has never played around with your privacy. While other .coms make their money by selling your information, Vibrators.com never has and never will. And when you use the special code BOOTH, that's B-O-O-T-H, at checkout, you'll receive free priority shipping on any order. That's Vibrators.com. Get a little excitement in your life.
Excuse me, what are you doing? Are you looking for porn again?
No.
Well, what is that I see?
It's not porn. It's the badassboobsandbodycounts.com website. I happen to be looking at the reviews in the boobs section of the site.
They have a section of the site dedicated to boobs?
Yes, they do. They cover exploitation films in the boobs category, action films in the badass category, and horror in the body counts category.
What's that other option, BBNBC podcast?
If you're not into reading the reviews, you can listen to them via the web on your mobile device through iTunes, and they cover the same types of films, lesser known action, exploitation, and horror cinema. So yeah, to answer your question, I wasn't cruising porn.
That's too bad.
What's too bad?
That you weren't cruising for porn.
Why?
Because I was feeling kind of horny.
Ooh, wait, get back here. Hey, get back here.
How did you get into the business?
I went to UCLA Film School. That wasn't exactly how I got into the business, but it sort of, I mean, that was my interest. So I was there during the days of Jim Morrison and Ray Manzarek were my classmates there. And it was a pretty, it was a fabulous time for, I don't know, I can't speak for everybody, but I had a great time being there. And so I made my student film, and my student film went to Royce Hall, which was a big deal because only so many could get there, you know, and many of the student films were chosen. And then after that, I knocked around. I did a lot of different things, and I lived in New York, and I traveled in Europe, and I did film dubbing there, and I worked on all sorts of jobs all over the place in New York and et cetera. I came back to Los Angeles and I'm trying to think how this happened. Oh, I came back to Los Angeles and I hooked up with a friend of mine and who had also gone to a film school with me. And I made a movie called Lamora, and that was a horror film. It's on Synapse put it out with as well as it can ever be seen, and DVD. And when it came out, it was a total disaster. Was complete failure, and now it's got this cult status and all this accolades, and was shown at the Lincoln Center, et cetera, et cetera. So, showing that sometimes if you just wait long enough, people will get around to what you did and like it. At any event, so that didn't get me anywhere really, because it pretty well crushed me. Everybody had so high hopes for that movie, and since it was, like I say, just we went into all kinds of financial difficulties, and the movie almost wasn't released, but it was released, and it did get out there. And then I chanced to meet. My girlfriend at the time was friends with somebody who had gone to UCLA before I had gone to UCLA, and that was Paul Bartel. And I met him. He was doing a script. He was doing a film called Death Race 2000, and he had the script, and he gave it to us to read, just for us to read. And the story I always tell is I was reading the script, and I, somewhere in the middle of the script, I came upon a description of a shot that was close-up of a bomb disguised as a baby. And I said, I can work with this guy. And so I let that be known, and I said, look, if you want to collaborate on something. The interesting thing is that we had both done our first movie the same year. He had done... what was it called? I can't remember the name of it.
Private Parts?
Private Parts, exactly, for Gene Corman. And I had done my little independent movie. And there's some odd similarities between those movies. But he said, oh, yeah, let's collaborate on something. I have an idea. And so he came to me with the idea. He wanted to do a movie called Frankencar. And it was about it was a guy who was like injured, a race car driver injured, and he gets built into the actual body of a car, almost like a centaur myth or something, where he's under the hood, his torso and head. And it was so outlandish that I was pleased to try to do something like that because it was so wacky. And I think he was trying to get out of the Corman thing with the cars and stuff like that into something a little more quirky, which it definitely would have been. And the funny thing about that script is it has never really died out, because it isn't, not a year goes by that somebody doesn't get in touch with me about it and wanting to do it, and it never happens. It's just one of those scripts. But even when it's rewritten, it never happens. At any event, that didn't happen. And then there were a couple of other things that we tried and whatever. And then at one point, the Eating Raoul came about, and that's a whole story unto itself.
I said, so what's that story?
Well, I tell that a lot of times. I don't know, but I can tell it again. I had several scripts out. He had several scripts out, because we wrote independently. He always wrote in collaboration, actually, Paul did, I think. I had a few things out, and I also wrote in collaboration with this friend of mine, Bob Fern, that we had also worked on the vampire movie, the Lamora movie. But nothing was happening, I was living on top of this garage in Hollywood, and one day I got a call from Paul Bartel. And he said that Roger Corman wanted to make a film with him and Mary Warnoff. This was a total lie, but he told me that so I would be interested, or try to get me interested in working on something with him again. So I said, well, because of course I was interested. Well, Roger Corman wants, that means there's money, that means we might get paid, that means a film might actually get made. So I said, well, what do you have in mind? And he said, well, I think we could be like detectives in Florida. I don't know where that came from, but that was in his head. And I said, I don't think anybody wants to see that Tony Rome jive. And he goes, well, what do you think? And I, out of the, it was just blue sky. I just said, I think you ought to be a sexless married couple, you know, that just kills people for their money. And he said, let's talk about that. And so I said, all right. So he said, well, can you, let's go to Schwab's. At that time, Schwab's was still extant on the Sunset Strip. So we went down and we met there. I guess we're both about 5 minutes away from it. And drove down there individually and met and sat in a booth and hashed the thing out very quickly, actually, in basic form. And his idea was, well, if we're going to be a sexless married couple, then we need a lover for Mary. And then he said, and I said, well, what do you think? He says, well, maybe a Latin lover. And I said, well, if he's a Latin lover, I think he should be like a guy from the street, not some Jose de Villalonga character or something. And he goes, that's fine. And I said, oh, wait, well, I know what he does, too. I know his name and I know what he does, because on Fairfax, there is a place called Rowell's Key Service. And that was my neighborhood. I knew it. So there was his name, Raul, and he was a phony locksman that would come in and pretend to put locks in and then later rob the. So, I mean, it all came together, brainstorming it very quickly. Then when we got all that straightened out, and Paul wanted to have a dominatrix in it. I remember that. And then again, I did my thing and said, well, if she's going to be a dominatrix, she has to be completely ordinary and suburban and all that. So we go back and forth like that with, and it actually worked well. And I think just as a general overlook, you know, I had one time I said to him, well, you know, what we should do is we should go down to these like swinging singles apartments and, you know, because they're going to murder these swingers. And really, like, you know, get into it and see what the story is with these people. And Bartos, I have no interest in that. He was so funny. He didn't care, because his thing was more like Sweeney Todd, and my thing was kind of like the Honeymoon Killers. So in a weird way, those two sensibilities that we had, if it was left to me, I think it would have been, I would have come up with something so dark and depressing, it probably would have been made. And if it was all up to him, it might have been such a candy fluff that it wouldn't have been made in that way. But sort of together, we found some middle ground. At any event, we had gotten the story together, and Paul was asked to be on the jury at the Berlin Film Festival. So he wangled, saying, well, my co-writer has to come because we're working on the script. So they said, fine. I guess in those days you could do that. So you had money or something. So they flew us both to Berlin. And I basically wrote the script in the hotel while Paul Bartel was seeing Living High and eating well and seeing movies. And I was like whacking on the keys at that time, just on a, you know, at that, because there were no word processors then. We worked on an actual typewriter back, boy, it seems like a million years ago. But so the first draft was written there in Berlin, and after that we refined it and worked it and worked it, and then we tried, of course, to raise the money. Well, the first thing we did was, so we thought, or Bartel believed, that he would shoot some of the movie. And if we had got that done, then maybe we could interest people in financing the rest of the movie. And he had enough, I guess, short ends or something like that to cobble together some scenes. And we shot the beginning of the film. I wasn't actually there. I was in London. I was working on some scripts over there for a production company. And so he put that together. He was working on that. He put that together. He didn't get anybody. The only thing, Buck Henry agreed to be in it. That was about the only thing that resulted from this 20 minutes of film. But here's also what happened. We shot that, or he shot that, within the apartment of a friend of mine who had this very 50s apartment decorated that way. In fact, the art director hardly had to do anything. So as you see in the film, that is exactly the guy's apartment. And the apartment building that my friend Art Fine was going to be razed. It was going to be destroyed. So the fire was really put up under our asses because we didn't want to go back and reshoot it. So Paul scrabbled around, and as luck would have it, his parents were moving from New Jersey to Florida, and they sold the house. And with some of the proceeds from the house, they gave him the money to complete the film. And that's kind of a depressing thing, because when we would show the film and young filmmakers would say, how did you get this on? You know, hoping that we'd say, well, we showed people this brilliant footage and they threw money at us. That just didn't happen. That's how it got on. It was a parental production.
I take it that the casting of Paul and Mary was pretty much out of necessity, since they knew that they weren't going to have that much money and just had to have these, you know, they had to be around for it.
Exactly. Well, of course, the idea there was Paul had seen Mary in New York in the Theater of the Ridiculous, the Charles Ludlam thing, and he brought her out, I guess, back out to Hollywood. She had been there previously on tour with an Andy Warhol group, and she, because she was really sort of a New Yorker anyway, and part of the factory scene, when he brought her out to be in Death Race 2000. So he had... he knew her fairly well, and also I don't remember. See, Rock and Roll High School. That's right. They had done Rock and Roll High School too for Alan Arkush and Joe Dante and Alan Arkush. No, that's Hollywood Boulevard. Who directed Rock and Roll High School? That was Alan.
It was Arkush, but I believe that Joe directed a couple scenes because Alan got sick.
Okay. Anyhow, so. So he knew her well, and he wanted to, he thought they worked well as a comic team. So that was, you know, it was not only economic necessity, it was also something that he had started from, even saying back to me that those years ago, Roger Corman wants to make a movie with Mary and myself. So he wanted to make a movie with himself and Mary in it.
How close are Paul and Mary Bland to Paul and Mary in real life?
Whoa. Well, they're not close. That's a total construct. In fact, you know, Mary Warnoff had up to that point basically, and she was called Mary Might in the Warhol days and all that, she had played, I don't know, and she continued after our film to still play weird dyke wardenesses and you know, motorcycle queens and sort of tough roles. And I wanted to, after meeting her and seeing the range that she exhibited just in speaking to you, I wanted to emphasize a more childlike part of her that I thought would be funny that she could do. And now, as for Paul, there's something of Paul Bland in him, in that he could be, what could you say, a little bit of a fuss budget about some things, or a little bit, you know, repressed. Or what, I don't know. I don't exactly know how to say it. He had almost a mid-Atlantic accent, and he had his little affectations or whatnot, and was aware of them. And you know, could make comedic use of them, and so in that case, yeah, I suppose there were certain things more. I'd say more his character was closer to him than Mary's character was to her.
He talks about this kind of mix of sensibilities, like you were going really dark, he was going kind of fluffy. Do you think there was kind of like a West Coast, East Coast kind of thing going on there?
No, I think. Not at all, really, because Paul, I don't think it had anything to do with that. First of all, we're both, I mean, I was born in D.C., and I came out to the West Coast, and I couldn't stand it. I went to college at SC my freshman year, and I couldn't stand the place, and I left, and I went to University of Michigan, and I'd lived in New York. But there's a thing about Southern California that obviously I did like because I kept coming back to it and finally made my home here. So I don't think it was anything to do geographically. I think it was just more to do with our individual tastes and our outlooks on things, and that we could work well because even though, well, you know, we obviously had all kinds of arguments about things. I mean, Paul, for one thing, operated a great deal as a producer in that he would have the, and I think a lot of people that initially when working for Corman and Corman doing this too, they'd have, it would be the concept. They'd grab this concept and then the concept would sort of take care of everything. And Paul would be fond of saying, I think at this point the audience would like, and he'd mention something, you know, fairly outlandish, and then I'd have to, if I'd either argue that it was too bizarre and it wouldn't work, and it wouldn't suspend, people wouldn't be able to suspend disbelief. That's what I was, you know, worried about a lot of times, and it would be to me to try to work it out so they would be able to suspend disbelief. So that's because I think in a writing partnership, you usually have somebody, almost always, who is more objective and somebody who is more subjective. And with Paul, it was more objective. He'd just get an idea, you know, and he'd fall in love with a concept or an image like that. And then it was how to work it, you know. But I must say also, in praise of him, because once we did that movie, we had to cut stuff, and he was very good about that, because if it wasn't working or he thought it was slowing the movie down, he was pretty ruthless and he'd cut it.
I don't know if this is just kind of happenstance or if it was really planned out. I mean, the movie comes out in 82, but it seems so steeped in like this kind of Reagan era sensibility. Is that just lucky or was that the plan?
It wasn't, I don't think it was that, thought out, but we were talking about the me decade. You know, and that was the big time of the me decade, and it was like, and it was very, by 82, you know, actually, I sort of figure, and this is a thing that I do, is thinking of not when actual decades end chronologically, but maybe they end more by some sort of national occurrence or something. Like I would date actually the 50s actually ending with Kennedy's death, because I believe after Kennedy's death the 60s actually began. And I could say that the 70s in a way ended with John Belushi's death, and that was like, you know, that was like wretched excess, and it ushered in a sort of minimalism with the 80s, and we were right on the cusp of that.
Right.
So that, but I don't know if it was thought out. It was just something that would be, I just thought was, you know, I mean, we just thought we were trying to make a funny movie. But of course, you get all, I mean, I remember when I did, I made
We're sorry, but we've run out of time. Be sure to listen to the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.